This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy, do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Dear Prudence once again, and as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg. With me in the studio today is my good friend Noah Colwin, and I'm very excited to introduce you all to one another. But first, I've recently received another update on what I believe is the only appropriate and effective way to date your boss. Because I get a lot of letters, you guys, about people who want to date their bosses. And I can't say that I've ever had a boss I really wanted to date. I can't say I've ever employed anyone I really wanted to date, but it seems to just be sweeping the nation. You guys get to work and all you think about is whether or not you can date your boss. Usually, it seems like the answer is no. Usually, people write into me with stories about their boss, and it does not sound like a great start. But the update I got was from somebody who had said, my boss gave me this look when we were out at a company dinner, and I think that means that she wants to be with me forever. And I responded with some skepticism, but essentially said, look, whatever the story between the two of you is, it's probably not going to be that you get together while she has like direct hiring and firing power over you. Like if she's really the one, it's probably it's going to be at a different time in your life. And the guy finally wrote back and he said, you were right. I gave it a few months to see if my feelings would die down. They didn't. I got a different job with a great reference from my current boss. And then we met up for dinner a couple of weeks later, confessed our feelings for one another, and now we're very happy together. And I would like to take total credit for that. That's on me. That's 100% my thing. I will get to come to the wedding and give a toast, and everyone will have to like do that thing where they put me up on a chair and go, huzzah, as they like lift me towards the ceiling. And I'm very excited about it. And that's it. That's the only way you can date your boss, is to get another job and then go get dinner and say, by the way, do you love me too? So now that we all know that, I want to jump right into introducing you all to Noah Colwin, who is the technology editor of Vice News. One time, we saw a pigeon getting its head eaten off by a rat when we were on a walk together. Hello, Noah.
Howdy. I love thinking about such fond memories like that.
I think about that so often. It felt so on the nose. It was like, we get it.
Was that the time that we thought we saw a Rat King after we saw, what was it, like Jurassic
World? It was Jurassic World. We were walking around Lake Merritt in Oakland, and it was nighttime, and I saw what I thought was like a black plastic bag from a liquor store on the road in front of us. And as we got closer, I realized it was a dead pigeon. And then as we got even closer, we saw the rat scurrying away with its head in its mouth into the bushes.
See, I think a hack would say that there was a metaphor in there, but I'm not a hack, so I'm not going to say that there was a metaphor. I'm just going to say that it was an incredible phenomenon to witness, and that I'm grateful for having encountered it with a dear friend.
And I would say it was as good as Jurassic World, which is not, by the way, a knock on Jurassic World.
You know, I'm still thinking years, I guess, however long it was ago that we saw it, that Dallas Bryce Howard was in heels the whole movie.
She was in heels the whole movie, and neither of us were in heels even a little bit, which just reminds me of how much better Bryce Dallas Howard is than both of us.
Absolutely.
But I'm kind of looking forward to this, because my last couple of guests have been very responsible, practical people, and I feel like you and I have always brought out a really wonderful dirtbag energy in one another, and I think we'll be able to bring that sort of dirtbag energy to the questions.
Well, let me put my feet up on the table, suck on a vape pen, and go through dispensing wisdom, thinking about how the Trailer Park Boys would do it.
Speaking of which, oh my gosh, I forgot to tell you this, and I have to tell you all this now. This weekend, I was at a coffee shop with a friend, and somebody walked in, and I immediately forgot everything I'd ever known, and all I could think about was how much I wanted to follow this person around for the rest of their life. It was this guy in a leather jacket who had an unlit cigarette between his lips, which, like, the last time you could smoke indoors anywhere was, what, 80 years ago? Forever ago. No one just walks in with an unlit... And you could tell it had been between his lips for a while, like the filter was getting damp and kind of falling off. But he was so committed to, I might need to start smoking this at any second. I do not have time to put it behind my ear. And then he turned and I saw that he was carrying a keytar.
What the fuck? What? Yeah.
So I just immediately wanted to dedicate the rest of my life to understanding him. He passed out of my life later that afternoon, but I miss him every day, and I would like to dedicate this episode to him.
Keytar man, if you're listening, you should write to Dear Prudence.
Please call me. I love you. All right. So the first letter, the subject line is just, Mom needs to step off, which is so often true. Dear Prudence, recently my 8-year-old daughter has started saying she wants to be a boy. Okay, not ideal, but I asked her why and her answer was simple. It's hot out and she wants to take her shirt off like the boys do. She's also happy to dress like a girl. She loves makeup, playing with dolls, crushing on the YouTube boys, so I'm not too worried about her gender identity, and if she ends up being genderqueer, it won't be the end of the world. I want to be supportive, as the only parenting fail in my book is failing to be there when your kid needs you. My problem is with my mother. She's heard the I want to be a boy comments, and she's a fundamentalist. I don't want her blowing this out of proportion. Recently, she told me to, quote-unquote, pray it away after I let my daughter play football. At this point, I feel like my daughter's biggest problem is people telling her she can't do things because she's a girl. I'm looking for advice on how to tell my mom to back off and stop telling my daughter not to do things that society says are for boys. Sure. I love the idea of praying away football. That's
one. Also, that sounds like a South Park gag.
It does. It does.
Like, it's like, oh, I just want to pray my daughter's football urges away.
Yeah, which I think is definitely not in this woman's purview as a grandmother, right? Like, I think probably you and I are both going to be on the same page about this. Like, her mom should not be saying this stuff to her kid.
Yeah, I think, like, the question then is, like, how many expletives should this person use when talking with their mother about how much she should be stepping out or how much she should not be saying, hey, listen, girl, don't play football. Don't exhibit any masculine traits. Like, it's obviously a grandma problem.
Yes. Yeah. And so I think your instincts, letter writer, are probably 100% spot on. Like, your daughter does not need to get this messaging from her grandmother. And also it's probably true that she has at least for now, like, stable gender identity as a girl. Like, lots of kids will talk about wanting to be a boy or wanting to be a girl, and that can mean a variety of different things. It can mean they're a tomboy or a tomgirl. It can mean that there's, like, a possible trans identity. It could mean that they're gender nonconforming. Like, you know, it sounds like right now what your daughter is just expressing is a pretty, like, low-key desire to do some boy things, and there's not more to it than that, and that's fine. But yeah, there's no reason for your mother to be worried about a, like, 8-year-old playing football.
To my mind, like, then the question then becomes, like, you know, how forceful do you want to be with grandma, and do you want to say, hey, look, if you are going to continue to blow this out of proportion against my wishes, then I'm going to have to limit the time that you two spend together, or we're going to have to talk about what you can and can't say around her. Or, you know, as was the case with my grandma, my parents just let me spend a lot of time with her and then would, you know, provide appropriate context afterward and say, by the way, we love her because she's family, but also, like, take everything you heard with a grain of salt. And if you have any specific questions, feel free to ask us.
That is super helpful, actually, I think, because, you know, periodically you'll get a letter like this where it's pretty clear that, like, the grandparent in question needs to have their time with the kid really seriously limited. And I think this is a situation that could kind of fall into a couple different possible camps, right? Because depending on how intense the grandmother's being with the kid, it may not necessarily mean that, like, she can't see her ever. It might just mean this is a great opportunity for, like, when you, letter writer, hear her say something like, you shouldn't play football, to just say, absolutely you can, and it's great. Mom, knock it off. And then, but not necessarily say, you can't see my kid, and then afterwards sort of check in with the daughter. Can you tell me a little bit more about, like, what that was like for you when you were a kid? Like, was it confusing? Did it feel pretty clear to you that your grandmother was an outlier?
Well, at a certain age, definitely. Like, probably when I was, like, 8 or 9, you know, you get whiffs of it. But I think it was when I was older that I think my parents sort of provided an appropriate context. And, you know, I love my grandmother. My parents love my grandmother. I think it was just a real sort of, like, all right, this is part of growing up, is that you are going to be in contact and you are going to have real life experiences with people whose views and attitudes are different from your own. And I think it's really important. And I think my parents, you know, they weren't ever really this explicit about it, but I think that they kind of made it clear what about it wasn't, you know, to their tastes, and why, if I ever felt frustrated or upset with something she did, that like, to understand the context in which it came, which is that my grandma had a radically different life than I did and was a radically different kind of person for my parents, and that's just how it is. Again, it's, you know, I think it kind of comes down to the letter writer's judgment over is that contact by itself, you know, super damaging to your kid. And you know, that's something I think for the letter writer to decide. But I think sort of like conditioning time is the way that I would understand most people might think about how to deal with this if they can't just, you know, figure out like all right, here's the context of this. But it seems like the letter writer is pretty explicitly asking how to address the grandma. And,
right.
And the first thing that just comes to my mind is like, all right, let's talk about conditioning time if you can't behave.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's really fair. I think there are two conversations that need to be had. One is with the grandmother, and that needs to be just a really basic, hey, mom, I'm really comfortable with my daughter playing football or being a tomboy or sometimes wearing boys' clothes or anything along that line. I'm comfortable with that, and I need you to let it go. I don't believe that it's dangerous. I don't believe praying would be a useful response. I don't believe praying is a necessary response. And you need to not hassle my kid about this. And then the other conversation needs to be with your daughter, of just saying like, hey, your grandma is pretty old fashioned about what girls can and can't do. And I disagree with that. And I think playing football is great. And, you know, whatever else is falling into that category, go for it. If you ever have questions about it, please feel free to tell me. If your grandma's giving you a really hard time about it, let me know, and I'll be happy to step up for you. But yeah, just kind of doing that check-in with your kid of just saying like, yeah, you will occasionally run into people like this in your life. I believe that they're wrong. I think what you're doing is great, and that will be helpful for your daughter in kind of figuring out how to deal with people like her grandmother.
Yes, I agree.
Good. Oh, well, I'm glad. I didn't think either of us were going to be like, yes, you should pray that she never plays football again.
Yeah, just, you know, get down on the knees, roll out the prayer mat, and, you know, just think real, real hard about the sins you've committed.
I mean, if there's any concern about your daughter playing football, it would be the concussions, right? Like,
yeah,
that's,
I was
going to
say, like, if you really want, like, if grandma was at all savvy here, she would just play, you know, like, take her to see that Will Smith movie, Concussion.
Yeah, but I feel like probably an 8-year-old is not playing tackle football.
No.
I don't think, I don't know a lot about football, but...
And I also think that the concern here isn't really about the, yeah, actually, you know, I was going to say, like, the thing that I was concerned reading about this is like, an 8-year-old wants to play football today?
I have to imagine it was like a flag game with a bunch of her little buddies outside.
Yeah. Or she like saw Rudy at a friend's house or something.
Oh, dang it. You know, some kids are too young for Rudy. That's too much inspiration for
an
8-year-old.
Rudy was what turned my brother onto football.
Is he okay now?
Yeah, I mean, he played college. I mean, he's fine now. He's happy and,
okay.
and like 16 years out from the last time he played a snap of tackle football, and he seems to be pretty good. So,
okay, good.
Knock on wood.
Glad to hear that. All right.
Yeah.
So this next letter I'm going to have you read, and I need you to know this has been sitting in my inbox for months because I have gone back and forth on it so many times. So I'm really hoping that you will be the key that helps me unlock the answer.
Subject, cute or creepy? Dear Prudence. I'm in a loving relationship with a sweet but socially awkward guy. I'm his first boyfriend, but this is one of the best relationships I've ever had. Recently, I was going through the pictures in his phone and found that he had snapped some pictures of me when I wasn't looking, candid photos from before we were even dating, as far back as a couple years ago. I showed him and he told me he had a crush on me for a while. Apparently, I helped him when he got lost once, which I don't even remember, and he was going through a difficult time in his life then, so my being nice had meant a lot to him. He was too shy to actually talk to me, and it was only by coincidence that I even noticed him and talked to him. Honestly, I was really moved when he told me this, but when I told my friends, they were creeped out. He took pictures of you for 2 years and stalked you on social media? What kind of creepy weirdo is he? But we live close together, he'd run into me because we went to the same coffee shop, park, etc., and we've been dating for over a year and nothing about my boyfriend has made me feel threatened. My friends are all convinced I'm going to end up dead in a dumpster. It doesn't help that my boyfriend is anxious and shy around people he doesn't know very well, so my friends never really got to know him. I feel horrible for giving my friends the wrong impression, and I feel like I've betrayed my boyfriend's confidence by sharing the story. I thought it was sweet. I never would have told him otherwise. At the same time, all my friends are telling me my boyfriend is a creep and I'm seeing things through rose-colored glasses. I guess I need an objective opinion on this. Is this a red flag, or are my friends paranoid? Should I have stuck up for my boyfriend better? I talked about this with my boyfriend, and all it did was make him cry.
Everything about this letter makes me feel so sad for kind of everyone involved.
Really. I guess on the first point, like the photos thing, it doesn't sound that the difference between what his friends say is stalking and what this is,
right.
Seems pretty substantial to me. Like this is not stalking. Is it kind of creepy? Maybe. But if you found it endearing, then it doesn't matter.
Right.
I guess what just kind of concerns me about the letter is the gap between what the letter writer describes and what the friends perceive. Like something doesn't add up there. And I'm inclined to say, look, it just sounds like your friends don't have many friends with really poor social skills. And on the other hand, it sounds like maybe there's something the letter writer's omitting that would lead friends, multiple friends, to this conclusion.
Yeah, there's definitely a breakdown in communication for sure. And so much of what I've been going back and forth on are two things, one of which is I feel like it would really help to know how many pictures there were. And like,
yes.
What they're like if it's, you know, 5 or 6 from before you guys started dating and it's sort of like across the way in a coffee shop and you're like on the phone, that falls into like awkward but could be potentially charming territory versus like if it's 20, 30, 40, 50 and a lot of them are you like thinking that you are kind of in private, that would feel different to me. But
yeah,
I don't know. And all I have is what the letter writer's perception is, which the letter writer does not think there were a lot or that it's creepy or that they were invasive. So I think kind of based on that, that's the one thing. The other thing that I've kind of gone back and forth on is like, would I feel differently if this were a male-female couple versus two guys? And I don't know. I keep thinking like, am I being easier on him because they're both guys? Or like, would I feel different if one of them was a woman? And I don't know.
I mean, I guess what like the thing that to me matters the most, because that thought definitely occurred to me when I initially read it. The thing that kind of matters to me is, you know, like the letter writer doesn't seem that perturbed about it until someone else told him. And if the letter writer doesn't feel perturbed and he's never felt threatened in over a year with this person, then I have a hard time believe, you know, like barring the fact that the thing that we don't know, like whether or not it's 50 pictures or 5, it just doesn't sound like this is that bad of a thing. And I can also more easily imagine a situation in which you, like the letter writer, correctly perceives that this is not that big of a deal, but friends being friends, you know, like are like, oh no, that's creepy. And because they don't know this person, or don't really have the opportunity to know this person, they like, it just seems creepy because of that distance.
Right. And I'm curious too, like that your friends would say that he stalked you on social media versus, I'm wondering, like, did he just follow you on Instagram or Twitter and like ran into you in the coffee shop, or did he like every week for a year engineer like being in your path? I don't know. I'm trying to think of like when I was in high school, like I would like sometimes like engineer my like walk to class to see somebody that I had a crush on or I thought was really cute, and like that felt not stalking, but like I can identify with that. Like certainly, like I think we have all gone out of our way once or twice to see somebody we thought was cute, but there's definitely a point at which it crosses over into pretty intense territory, and I'm not sure where exactly that line is.
Right. And to me, it's sort of like it comes down to this person didn't perceive it as creepy. And it was only when people who didn't know, who don't know his boyfriend, suggested that it was creepy that it became an issue. So I'm like not too hung up on whether or not it's creepy. I guess what's more concerning to me is that like if multiple people have this perception and they don't know him, then like the thing it suggests to me is that like, you know, if you really care about this person and he does have social like serious social awkwardness, this is probably not the only time or the first time that he's been in a situation like this where people have like grossly misperceived his behavior because they haven't had an opportunity to get to know him. Right. And if you're his partner and it's your friends and you want to maintain both these friendships and a serious, you know, private life with this person, then I guess I would, you know, try and like figure out what it would take to bridge that gap.
Right.
And that seems like, you know, like one of the burdens of being in an adult relationship with somebody who needs this kind of help.
Right. And I think, too, it also jumps out to me that I'm rereading that like their relationship started because the letter writer noticed him and talked to him. So like clearly it's not as if their relationship began because this guy like engineered a path into this guy's life and like pretended to be someone that the letter writer would like. Like there's not that element of creepiness there. So like I feel like, yes, I'm going to go with. I think the letter writer knows the relationship well. I think that they are right when they say that they feel very safe and comfortable. I'm going to trust their judgment there. I don't have any big, big red flags jumping up. So with that in mind, yes, it does make sense that your friends would be a little more skeptical than you because they don't know your boyfriend. And basically all they know about him is that he took a lot of pictures of you and like tried to be where you would be sometimes before you guys started dating. So like if that's the only thing they know about him, I understand the skepticism. So I think your job gets to be revisiting that with these friends before you try to get everyone to know one another and make it really clear, like make the following really clear, that you shared this story with them, not because any part of you feels threatened or unsafe or like this guy was obsessed with you, but because you were really flattered and you found it charming and you thought the pictures he took were not inappropriate, not invasive. And that you're really happy, like to stress that. So like, I want to reassure you, I am well, this is a good relationship, I'm safe. And then the next is my boyfriend is socially awkward. And that's part of why you guys haven't gotten to meet each other and spend time together. It's not because he's trying to like isolate me or keep me away from you guys. I would love for you guys to get to know him a little bit better. Would you be willing to give him a chance? Would you be willing to spend some time together with the two of us, knowing that he is a little, he's going to take a little while to come out of his shell? And hopefully your friends, when they hear you kind of explain it and put it into context and say, this is what I want from you, my friend, they will at least say like, yeah, I'm willing to give it a shot. And then if that's the case, you can go to your boyfriend and say, I really want us to try again with my friends. I'm so sorry. I shared that story with them. I did not know that that was going to be their response. They understand now. They're not looking to like grill you. Would you be up for sometime all of us like doing something really like low key together for a couple, like 2 hours max? Then we can go home and do something quiet.
I mean, the one thing that like is a little alarming to me in this is the thing at the end about how when I try to talk with him about this is just it makes him cry. Like if you can't have a conversation with him about this in like an adult fashion and in a way that's like presented non-threateningly, you know, without like any hint of malice or expectation, beyond like having a productive conversation and free exchange of feelings and ideas.
That's so socialist. Yeah. I love it.
Well, you know, like, so just, you know, to refer back to Karl Marx. No. But it does, like, I think you do have to on some level really kind of like level and be like, if I can't talk with him about right. this and it just makes him cry. Like that to me, I'd be curious about how you talk about other things. Like,
right.
How do you talk about like having a president who's like put us on the brink of nuclear annihilation? Like, I don't know. Like it seems in general kind of a tough position to be in more broadly. And I right. hope that you can find a way to talk about this with your partner
because
it involves him crying.
Certainly like, you know, and I'm pro crying. Crying is fine. But you say all he could do is cry. And like as much as this story is like certainly not definitively creepy, there's ways in which it can be charming. This also shouldn't be what defines his romantic future, right? Like, I mean, hopefully you guys are very happy together and you stay together forever, but like, this is his first relationship. So, you know, if in the future it doesn't work out between you guys and he goes on to have like a long adult life dating other people, this should not be how most of his relationships start out, right? Like, as charming as this might have been the first time around, I'm guessing you guys are both kind of young. He should not be doing this at like 30 and 35, right? Like, so the fact that he's still crying a lot about this suggests that maybe he does not have sufficient help for his social anxiety. I don't know if he sees a therapist. I don't know if he sees a doctor. I don't know if he has ever tried medication. I don't know if he's ever tried like cognitive behavioral therapy, or like group therapy or support group. Like, you know, if he's at a point in his life where he can't discuss like managing his own social skills without crying every time, then he needs more help than a boyfriend can give him. So maybe a separate conversation is, again, not like you're a bad person, you did something awful, you have to fix yourself so that my friends can like you, but like, hey, let's pay attention to this profound anxiety, this profound fear, this profound sense of I can't talk about this, I'm going to break down and cry, and give it the like attention and support that it deserves. So I think that would also be a part of the conversation, is to encourage your boyfriend to seek some sort of help for his social anxiety, beyond just being in a romantic relationship with you.
Agreed.
Cool.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Okay, let's jump to something that is a little bit less thorny and certainly is not going to take a decade to resolve. Will you read this next letter?
Yes, I love this letter. Subject, table manners. Dear Prudence, my boyfriend and I have been dating for 3 years. He will be graduating in a few months and hopes to find a job in business consulting, a field I once worked in. The problem is that my boyfriend has bad table manners. It's not like anything out of a horror movie, but he'll do things like lick his knife or cut up a whole steak before eating it. Business meals are a big part of getting and keeping a consulting job, and I have seen multiple hiring managers roll their eyes or otherwise call out a dining faux pas during the interview process. I want my boyfriend to be successful in finding a job, but I also want to be a supportive boyfriend, not a career coach. I have never brought up table manners with him, even though I'm the kind of horrible person that will ask for a salad fork at dinner and long ago accepted to privately cringe and love the other things about him. Can I bring this up while staying in the boyfriend lane? I need a script for how to make this about being successful in his career and not about how he eats at home. So first, I got to say, I love how he's so specific about what he wants, which is I need a script for how to do this thing. Mm-hmm. And it's already, he's like already arrived at what the morally just thing is here. And I agree with him. Because this is a real dilemma, and it's a really positive sign that he very clearly cares for supporting whatever decision, professional decision, his boyfriend wants to make, while recognizing that, like, I see something that will handicap him, and I recognize that, you know, professional advice could jeopardize that. So hats off to you, reader, for doing that.
Also, did you know that asking for a salad fork makes you a horrible person? Like, I thought that was a completely neutral thing to do.
I mean, like, so maybe the letter writer does have high standards, but you know what? He's also the person who used to work in this field, and I will defer to the letter writer on what the proper eating practices are in business consulting. What is the appropriate number of times to cut up a steak?
Even as somebody who has like worked from home for the last 4 and a bit years now, like, and has a pretty relaxed like approach to business dinners, because I don't really go on many of them, but yeah, like licking your knife and cutting up a whole steak, which I'm sorry, is just hysterical to me, because your steak will get so cold.
Exactly.
The whole steak. Yeah, no, like absolutely. Like, this is totally fair to bring up. They make salad forks. You shouldn't feel bad about them. It's not like you're asking for something imaginary. You're not being like, bring me the salad catapult. Like, they make salad
also
forks.
Like, do you really want to mix up like the dressing from your salad with your other foods? Like, I don't know. I understand some people like to keep their palates clean. I respect it.
I hear you.
But I would say that like the first thing is like, you know, to start this with saying like, you know, for what it's worth, none of the like, start off and say, hey, listen, I know you want to do this. I love and support you, and I want you to succeed. And so I want to give you a few advice that I learned from my experience. None of this are things that I care about that you do with me, but these are things perhaps to mind, you know, when you pursue this thing. And then, you know, to just like frame it with empathy. And if you feel that he is the kind of person who may not take to this, then that is perhaps a separate conversation. But, you know, you partner can, you know, you work with what you got, and what you got is the ability to approach this with like empathy and kindness, and the ability to say that none of these are things that afflict you personally, but that these are things that, you know, hiring managers may not respond to. And that is okay, because they are hiring managers, and here's how you got to just deal with them.
Yeah. And, you know, the letter writer doesn't say, like, my boyfriend's super sensitive about this stuff. So I would say, absent any reason to believe that he would be really
distressed. Yeah.
Aside
from the fact that you wrote this in the first place, that was
you
the
just
one
sound
thing
very conscientious. And,
yeah,
and I
exactly.
think you're kind of like, oh, a boyfriend should never criticize your table manners. And, like, I agree. You shouldn't, like, kick down the door and be like, you're a werewolf. Like, that's not something you should do. But I think you can take it kind of casually. Like, you can just say, like, hey, I feel a little goofy about this, but I think it will be helpful. Can I offer you a little advice? Like, kind of ask, check in, because, you know, you don't want to, you're not necessarily saying, like, I know everything, or, like, you know nothing. Like, you're just saying, in my experience, the standard for table manners in business consulting dinners is a lot higher than kind of average. And I've seen a lot of hiring managers get really persnickety about stuff. And so to that end, don't lick your fork, or don't lick your knife, and don't cut up all your food at once. And, like, here's a couple of basic rules. Like, you know, put down your fork and knife in between every couple of bites. What's that weird thing about buttering bread? You're, like, only supposed to butter bread a bite at a time. That's probably, like, fancy, fancy food, though, right? Not business food.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, I would just sort of, like, you know, I, like, one of the beautiful things about the internet is also that, like, there are tons and tons of guides and authorities on etiquette for appropriate settings.
Right.
That are, like, totally accessible, and to which you can defer, so that it doesn't seem like it's, you know, like coming from you, the boyfriend.
Totally. Yeah, you can point to, this is actually the standard. It's not my personal, like, bugbear.
Yeah, because, again, I don't care how many times you cut your steak.
Right. Yep. And I think the best thing to do is just be clear. Like, just open with, I'm a little worried about bringing this up with you, because, like, I think you're great, but I've seen this happen. I don't want it to happen to you. And then just be direct. Like, this is a situation where if you try to soften it or to sort of beat around the bush, it's actually just going to be slightly less helpful to him. So you should just rip off the bandaid and be like, don't lick your knife.
Although I am, like, kind of, you know, like now that we've laid out what is, like, the good advice here, I am, like, kind of amused about, like, the idea of just, like, purposely giving him, like, terrible advice. Like, all right, like, steak, the only condiment that should be allowed is ketchup. Well done.
I'm just picturing that scene where they eat in the cartoon Beauty and the Beast, and I think they're just eating, like, oatmeal, and he just, like, dips his, like, creepy bull face in it.
Yeah.
And I think he should do that.
So this is, I mean, similar effect. You don't consume soup with a spoon. You drink it from the bowl.
I fully drink soup from the bowl, by the way. Like, I mean, obviously not, like, at a business dinner where I'm trying to consult someone, but, like, I had soup last night.
Well, no,
it's actually
a sign of dominance when you just, like, take, like, a giant thing of ramen that's really spicy.
I really was dominating that soup.
Exactly. It's a power sign.
Yeah.
That's how it works. That's business. That's the business world.
Well, thank you for that business advice.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Woo! All right. No, I'm very excited that you're here for this one. My producer, by the way, when I sent over the questions, was like, are you going to answer that one? And I was like, sure, why not? Because why not? Dear Prudence, There's this online advice column that I'm absolutely obsessed with. It's a must read for me no matter what. My problem is that the site where this column is found has about 90% of its staff wanting to unionize, and the powers that be are opposing the idea. What makes the situation even more difficult is that the site fancies itself left-leaning and anti-Trump. I find myself not wanting to give a single click to the site until management wakes up. I normally don't support businesses that are hypocrites. However, I know that it may not help the staff themselves, and selfishly, I would miss out on some quality drama. Other than a heavily sarcastic, tongue-in-cheek submission asking about my dilemma, how can I make a difference here?
So, full disclosure, I am a member of Writers Guild of America East, which is working to unionize the Slate newsroom, or the Slate staff. So I like that. That is like an obvious bias that I have on the table. Advice: we have the digital editorial, the news staff for the websites, like broadly, the writers for Vice News, Munchies, Noisy, etc. The writers are covered under a union contract, and there is an ongoing effort to unionize some of the video production and TV folks at Vice as well. And Vice has been pretty receptive to those efforts. What I think though is sort of most important is you hit the nail on the head about the kind of like frustrating hypocrisy of these kinds of positions. But what I think is really critical is you know, to show solidarity with the staff. Fundamentally, if a group of people want to unionize and they exercise their rights and they have, you know, overwhelming support to do so, management opposition can become futile. A really good example of this that's happened recently was at Group 9 Media, which operates Thrillist and the Dodo and some other digital properties. And their management did not respond all that favorably initially, and actually went a step further than Slate Group and held compulsory, what are called captive meetings, to say a union's bad news. And eventually they backed down because the staff wanted to unionize. They walked out. They drew their lines clear. So I think you identify correctly, you know, like, arg, this is crap. This is bullshit. This is unfair. But the real pivotal thing about what you can do as a loyal reader is, you know, if you are on Twitter or on Facebook, like, let other people know, show solidarity. Is there a hashtag they're using? These sound like small steps, but sort of illustrating that there are a consequences in the public eye for how management deals with this is what's really important, because that's how you hold them accountable.
No, I'm just curious too, in terms of like whether it's more useful to say something on social media versus like emailing management or sending like a letter to an editor. And again, this is like something that could be true for any organization that you are a part of where workers are attempting to unionize. Like, I think this is a useful question just in general. Like, what can I do that's most useful? Is not reading a website or not like dealing with a business where workers are trying to unionize, is that the best choice that I have, or do I have other options?
So I think the first step is to, you know, like defer to the people who are unionizing and sort of, you know, email. You know, you seem to have this advice columnist you really like. If you really want to know what to do, what I would do is email her and ask, hey, listen, you know, I want to show support, but I don't want to email, you know, an executive. And even if I think it's a really polite email, if it may end up backfiring.
Well, and for what it's worth, I'm not an employee. I'm on a freelance contract. So
I would then, you know, email an editor or a person you like, somebody who you expect is part of the group that's unionizing and who you may feel who you know to be or you perceive to be sympathetic to this, and ask what you can do. And I'm sure that they could give you an idea of what would be appropriate and desirable.
Right.
What I think is a little bit, you know, where it gets a little bit tricky is, you know, if you're to write an email or to do something to somebody and the staff doesn't know about it and it's like really aggressive, then it can backfire. Even if it's not aggressive, but like, you know, somebody takes a line out of context or something, then it could be perceived as that, and it can, you know, end up being used as ammunition against the union or something. I don't want to like say that's inevitable and that's what's going to happen, but you know, that's the possibility for it.
Right. Yeah, and it sounds like
the possibility for that.
Yeah, no, and I think that's really useful, especially because this person already sounds pretty like well informed about like where the unionization sort of push is coming from. So yeah, I think find those people, ask sincerely, like, what do you think is the most helpful thing that a reader can do? And you know, you can also, if there's something that's been on your mind about like letter to the editor, finding a hashtag, saying something on social media, whatever, like you can say, would this be useful to you? And if the answer is yes, then like do it. And that would be, I think, probably more effective than simply not reading.
And I think another thing is, you know, one of the things that's really helpful is, you know, when you coordinate with the workers and coordinate with the union itself, you can always accomplish a lot more. So like what happens if you get in touch? Let's say you want to write a letter, an email to somebody. As a Slate reader, you know, you have a lot of power. You are probably the kind of person who management is nervously looking at when they're figuring out how to deal with this. And so to my mind, the thing that you can do is, you know, you can talk with the union and say, hey, listen, I want to write a letter, but I want to write a letter that, you know, maximizes its impact. And so if I send this letter, you know, like could you look at this and make sure it doesn't, you know, it wouldn't create any problems for you or something? Because maybe they can amplify it. Maybe they can boost it or something. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, it's showing solidarity is really, really important. And I think workers would respond really, really positively, writers and editors, in knowing that their readers had their backs. Because that's sort of, I think, what a lot of people in places that are working unionized kind of struggle with is the lack of feeling of support when management starts saying things like, a union's not right for us. It's not right for you. And you know, like making sure that there is somebody saying, hey, listen, I consume your content. I support you and I support your wishes. And I want to make that clear to the people who pay you to make stuff for people like me.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Like just making sure that there is an equally loud and powerful voice for unionization that's not just saying Lisa's dental plan. Sorry, it's Lisa needs braces followed by dental plan. That's so embarrassing that I smashed the two together.
Yeah. Well, you know, or do it for her.
No, that's not nearly as good. And that wasn't the unionization episode. It was a totally different episode.
It wasn't. I just was trying to think. I was just trying to think more of, well, wait, was it classical? No, that's the strike.
Classical gas. That is a union episode.
Okay,
thank
you.
Classical gas. Now do classical gas. Yes, exactly.
You know that became a meme, right?
Yes, Noah. I am familiar with Simpsons memes.
Okay, I'm just saying.
I am. I'm sorry. That's what I get all offended about. I'm like, yeah, let's talk about unionization. Like, but then I'm like, then how just like, dare you?
Excuse me.
But it is funny.
These are my memes.
It is funny. Like, I saw that letter and my first thought was like, oh, I'm not allowed to publish that. And then I was like, where did I get that idea from? Like no one has ever said that to me. It's just like a perception of like, oh, well, we're not allowed to talk about stuff like that, right? Like, that's probably, you can probably go to jail for that or something.
Yeah. I mean, I would say the other thing that's like, you know, really important also is that like, it's like one of the things that's like kind of hard with talking about like media unions and stuff like this is that it's really, really, you know, like before Gawker did it, before they were the first ones, you know, to go out and do it, people didn't really have an understanding of what sort of the tangible benefits of it might be.
Right.
And then Gawker got shut down. And, you know, you, letter writer, you seem very obviously like in tune and understanding of the benefits of this kind of thing. And of unionization for media workers. But what I think is especially clear and what you can make known in whatever you choose to do and, you know, however you want to publicly address this after, of course, speaking with the unionizing workers is, you know, like telegraphing, like, you know, like these are the benefits. These mm-hmm. are the things that, like, I understand why people need to do it. Because I think that there is like a lot of people may not really immediately understand that because it's like, hey, you have like an air conditioned office and comfy chairs and you get to write about like you just get to write all day. You get to read stuff like, you know, like unions are for people who like work in coal mines or are janitors and stuff. And, you know, aside from like the classism of that remark fundamentally, it's not that uncommon. And I think that there's like a really cool opportunity for you, dear reader, to explain and to articulate. No. Everybody can use a union because everybody deserves a voice.
Right. Or even thinking of like for freelancers, there's the National Writers Union, right? Which like has made some serious victories in terms of like figuring out copyright privileges, which is something that's really important to freelance writers. So there's a lot of work that has to do with like intellectual property and the rights to your own work that are really significant as writers. And obviously that's not always going to translate based on like what kind of writing you're doing. But I think unions are important and necessary and like at the very least deserve people making a public push for them. So, you know, toot on, son. See, that was another Simpsons meme. All right. Last question. We're ending with something that I think we'll just have an easy answer, which is going to be long answer, yes with an and, short answer, no with a but. Subject is just, should I ask out a former student? Dear Prudence, I've been teaching for a few years and up until now have never been attracted to any students. Congratulations. This past semester, I realized I wouldn't mind getting to know a particular male student. I've never acted on anything and I always treated him normally in class. To my knowledge, he doesn't know that I'm interested. We're both around the same age, as I'm a young instructor and he's an older student than most. The semester ended, but I wonder if there's any way to reach out for a casual date without seeming completely creepy. I'm also cognizant of the fact that if he doesn't take it well, it could get back to other people in my department. I'm not breaking a rule, but I don't want the gossip. By the way, I'm a woman. So I asked a friend of mine who is often on the show and who is themselves a, or who are themselves, who's also a professor. And their answer was, you know, basically ask your department chair and only consider asking the student out if there is a zero chance that you could ever have any responsibility for the student in the future. Because, like, even though you are not his teacher right now, if there's a chance he could take another class of yours next year, then the answer is and should be no. And so that was some, like, formal advice from a professor. I would also throw out there, you say that, to your knowledge, he doesn't know that you're interested. And there's nothing in your letter that suggests that he seems super into you. So, I mean, maybe you're just, maybe you know, I mean, you know the situation better than we do. But if he seems to have just totally seen you as a professor, it may not be worth the potential fallout and gossip, right? Because, like, if you ask him out, whether he says yes or no, he'll probably tell one person in his life at least. And that one person will probably tell a couple of people, and they will probably be like, did you hear about Professor X? She asked out a student. And, like, again, that's not great necessarily, but, like, if that doesn't seem worth the potential fallout to you, my vote is always going to be err on the side of don't ask out students. But, you know, no risk, no reward, I guess.
I agree with the professor, and I agree with Mallory. I mean, I think the only thing I'm kind of curious about is you've clearly identified, like, you know, what are the pitfalls of doing this and what are the negative consequences? I guess, like, I'm generally kind of curious about, you know, is this something that graduate students and instructors encounter frequently, and are there, like, standard accepted ways to like that, you know, how to, like, that people can know how to navigate this? Is there, like, a list of rules somewhere that somebody put together?
I think certainly, and I, big disclaimer, I'm not a professor. I don't work at a college. I'm just in a college recording studio right now. It's my understanding that if it's a student that you have any sort of institutional authority over, it is not okay to date or sleep with them. I don't know if that means that every institution has rules where, like, you could lose your job over it, or if you would just get, I don't know, like, reprimanded, but, like, it's generally considered if they're a student that you have the ability to, like, give a grade to or give a TA position to or, you know, review their dissertation, you don't get romantically or sexually involved with them. If they're from another institution or a department that isn't yours, I think depending on where you're at, it might be more kind of frowned upon, but certainly, like, allowed. But basically, you know, I mean, kind of like with work, kind of like with life in general, you know, if you have the ability to help or hurt somebody's career or future, you know, educational process, that's a real conflict of interest for romance, is my understanding. But yeah, I mean, like, I just got to say, like, letter writer, you say you wouldn't mind getting to know him. You want to reach out for a casual date. To me, that doesn't sound like sufficient escape velocity to start considering former students as potential romantic options. You know, like, I think it's always better to err on the side of a lot of people in the world to date. Why not date current and former students? And if the strongest thing you feel about him is, oh, I wouldn't mind eating food with him sometime, and I might like to casually go out with him, like, just that seems like a pretty easy impulse or desire to overcome, right?
Yeah.
Unless they're trying to seem more low-key about it than they really feel, because she doesn't want to seem creepy, which she says she doesn't want to seem creepy. And the best way to not seem creepy is to not ask him out. Number one.
Also, I love the language. I realized I wouldn't mind getting to know.
Yeah, that to me implies that like you are trying a little bit to manage your desire, which is like you probably realized a little bit more than that, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's like I wouldn't mind. It's that is like a you are really trying to desexualize whatever feelings
you may look, if
have
I
for him.
Stepped on a bear trap and he stepped on a bear trap and we were both flung into the air and landed at chairs at the opposite side of a table at a very fancy French restaurant, sure. I'd sit and have some steak with him. But
it'd be fine.
Yeah, I wouldn't
and you know, I wouldn't cut up the steak.
Yeah, I wouldn't cut up the steak. Excellent callback. Yeah, so I would say maybe also be a little bit like clear with yourself. How much do you like this student? Because if the answer is way more than I was willing to say in this letter, then you may decide it is worth the potential fallout. But yeah, I mean, I'm going to go the abstinence-only route with this and say the only way to make sure that there is no gossip and that people do not talk about you and that nobody thinks that you're creepy is not asking him out. You will have to decide if the possibility of those things happening is worth it to you to go out with him. Because certainly, it's not like people are going to run around saying that you're a monster. It's not like you're trying to date an undergraduate who is currently taking your course. Like,
no, yeah, but like, you know, it's you already initially recognize, like, I'm sure the letter writer recognizes, like, you know, with like, I don't want the gossip. I feel like that's a nice tip of the hat to like all of the justified or not shenanigans that people can talk about.
Right. Well, good luck if it's, you know, if it's something that you feel really, really strong about and you do ask him out and it goes well, let us know. And if you decide not to, let us know how that goes too. Noah, those are all the questions that I had for us.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me on, Mallory.
Thank you so much for being on and for giving such good, remarkably non-dirtbag advice. I kind of feel like now we should say something to make up for all that, like... I feel like I should be carving a Stussy S into the desk here.
Well, so, I mean, if you want to know whether to catcall the woman outside of the liquor store, don't.
Okay. Did you do that recently?
No, I'm just, I see it not infrequently. And, you know, I just as a bit of like advice on a dirtbag situation.
Oh, sure.
Sure. That's a thing. If you, speaking from personal experience, if you stand outside a coffee shop and a bird poops on your shoulder, when you go back into the coffee shop, be as gracious as you can about asking for napkins because people do look at you really funny when you've bird crap on your shoulder.
Please tell me that what you were wearing at the time was like a jean jacket with the sleeves cut off.
I was not. It was a blue varsity jacket kind of looking thing.
Also good.
And, this was like my longest period of not shaving. So I had like a really big beard and I was really cautious about like trying to like while I had like bird crap on my shoulder, I was like trying to like go through my beard. Like I didn't get any shit in here, did I? And so I did look a little deranged. I will concede. Hence the, you know, really like intense need for gratitude there because otherwise, I would have also probably not wanted to approach me.
Yeah. Noah, thank you. You are a beautiful flower, and I hope that nothing but good things ever happen to you for the rest of your life.
Thank you, and same to you, Mallory.
Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Audrey Dilling. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/dearprudence to subscribe. Remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short. 30 seconds, a minute, tops. If you're looking for more to listen to from Slate, check out the interview podcast, I Have to Ask, hosted by Isaac Chotiner. Each week, Isaac brings on newsmakers, celebrities, and cultural icons, and asks insightful, pointed, and at times difficult questions. Subscribe at slate.com/havetoask or wherever you get your podcasts.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy.
Chumba.
The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes.
Ch-ch-chumba.
ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.